Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chick lit that made us who we are. My name is Caroline O'Donoghue and I'm an author, a journalist and a person with a shared ownership in a pair of leather trousers. Joining me is author and the most beautiful Walsh sister of all, Louisa Neale.
who do you share the leather trousers with? Oh, yes!
Have you read this book?
It just dawned on me there, but in my head I was like, Okay, sorry. It will all become clear once we continue with this podcast. That literally hit me like that. I was like, what?
The shared leather trousers are like an extra character in the book.
Oh, it's so funny. That bit is, oh my God, I still remember. Anyway, sorry. I just thought it was like you were doing a play on like the Sisterhood of the Travelling. What's that title called?
Sisterhood of the Travelling Pants.
Yes.
A great choice for this podcast. And not what we're talking about today.
Not what we're talking about at all today. I'm so sorry, this is a terrible introduction to it, but anyway.
No, I'm enjoying it very, very much. As listeners will already know, because they'll have clicked on the episode expecting to hear things, we're talking about Rachel's Holiday by Marion Keyes. What made you choose this book, apart from the fact that it's the best book ever written?
Oh, it's so good. That opening line is just, I think, one of the best opening lines, like, ever written. It's funny, because I've been a Marion Keyes fan for years. I suppose, I remember certain novels that my mom would have had around the house when I was a kid. You know, there would have been like Maeve Binchy, and there would have been Patricia Scanlon. I remember the City Girls books. And then there was Marion Keyes, and I think I'm trying to remember when the first one came out. I think it was the mid 90s. But I remember reading Watermelon and being like, "Oh, this is really funny." Like, it felt very fresh and sort of different. I mean, I was only like 10, but at the time, it felt very fresh to my 10-year-old eyes.
This Keyes woman has something.
She really does. I think she's going to go far.
I was the same. I was kind of a preteen, and I read Watermelon as well. And I remember, and like we have this in the episode, but I remember feeling like it was the first time I had seen Irish middle class suburbia rendered.
Yes, yeah, and I suppose as well, her voice is so like distinctive, and the books are just really funny. And I remember reading all of them and just loving them. She was, you know, there's a few authors. Marion Keyes is one, and actually Margaret Atwood is probably the other, and Curtis Sittenfeld is another one that whenever they have a new book out, I'm there on like the day that it is released in the bookshop, determined to get it. You know, the ones that I'm like, oh, I might pick that up, or I'll order that from the library or whatever, but that I was like in there with my money, like, you know, ready to buy.
Exact change.
Yeah, exactly. And I suppose I remember when I first read Rachel's Holiday, I don't really remember it. Like, I remember being like, oh, this is brilliant, and you know, this is a really poignant story, but I reread it when I was in St. John of God's, when I was there with, I'd had anorexia, bulimia, and I was hospitalised when I was 21. And I remember I was reading it, and there's this scene in the book where, there was two scenes actually that I suppose that really struck me. And the first one is where she's taking cocaine by herself. And I remember thinking, God, it's so weird, because, you know, like in college and stuff, you know, everyone would be, you know, you'd be messing around with things. I probably shouldn't say that on a podcast. And you would never do that by yourself. Like, it was always something at a party or with other people. And I remember thinking, God, that's so strange that she would do that by herself, or that's a really sort of an addict behavior. And then there was this moment where I realized that when I would binge, or when I would do things like that, that was so secretive. And the way that Rachel sort of describes, you know, the going to buy the drugs and the process of handing over the money and, you know, the preparation and going back to her room and doing it, that was really familiar to me. And I think it was this moment, and I was in a hospital reading this book, and I had this moment, I put it down and I went, oh, I'm actually an addict.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So it was really, I suppose it was such a strange experience reading that book in a rehabilitation centre, when the book is about a rehabilitation centre, you know?
Yeah.
But it was a really powerful moment. And I suppose the first time that I, even though I was, in a hospital getting treated for this eating disorder, it was the first time I think I ever really admitted it, that to myself, because of that book.
And I suppose the book as well is so about, because the masterfulness of the book is that you start the book and it's this girl, Rachel, and she's just been admitted to a rehab center, the Cloisters, because of her overdose, and we're led to believe that's an accidental overdose, and she's just because you're a young person reading it, you're like, oh, everyone takes drugs, nobody understands, her Dublin parents don't get, coke is normal now, grow up, kind of thing. And then you by degrees realize in the book that she is a full-blown addict, and that, I mean, you hear about, you learn about unreliable narrators when you're doing To Kill a Mockingbird in primary school, but to me this is one of the best deployments of the unreliable narrator I've ever seen,
because it's so gradual, I suppose, the unraveling of that point of view, both for Rachel and for the reader as well. And I suppose you see that with the other characters as well. Do you know, there's a character called Neil, who his father was abusive, and he has become abusive, and he can't connect those two things that he has sort of, I suppose, that he's perpetuating this cycle of violence in his own family, because all he ever wanted was to be the complete opposite of what his father had done. So it's really, it's just such an interesting, it's just, I suppose, it's funny because I haven't read the book in years. I haven't, God, I'm trying to think. I probably haven't read it since that time in hospital, so that's like 13 years ago. And reading it, it still felt so fresh to me, and still felt, I remembered it so clearly, because I think the characters were all so well developed. And they, you know, I suppose the depiction of each of those characters and their struggle with addiction and how that manifested itself, and the way that they dealt with that, whether that was through denial or anger or frustration or, you know, or whatever, that just felt so incredibly authentic, actually, having gone through that myself, I suppose, and having been in a situation where you're in group therapy and you're having those conversations and you're watching other people, I suppose, figure some of their own issues out in real time.
And I also, it's, I guess, did you ever have that moment of arrogance where you're like, this group therapy is for everybody else's benefit and I cannot be therapized?
Well, I don't know if it was so much arrogance, because, you know, I knew that I had a problem. Do you know, it wasn't like with Rachel, where I suppose that she thinks that hers is only, you know, that it's social. Because I think when you have an eating disorder, you know, like, it's not like something that you're like, oh, I'm only, you know, I only binge and purge on a social level, because no one, like, you know the difference between how normal people eat and how normal people are around food and the way that you are, and there's a secrecy attached to that, which I think isn't when it comes to things like, I suppose, recreational drugs or drinking, you know, that I think that there's a kind of a veneer of respectability over that. And I could talk about addiction all day, because I just listened, I'm going to go a little bit off point here now, but I just listened to a really great interview with Gabor Maté, who's an expert in addiction, and that they're really reframing the way that they look at addiction now. And he would say that, you know, some are more socially acceptable than others, that you would look at something like someone who smokes a packet of 20, you know, smokes 20 cigarettes a day, and then someone who takes heroin every day. And obviously we would see one of those things as a bad habit and one of those things as a life-destroying addiction. But he said, actually, if you look over 20 years, if you look at the health and the physicality of both of those people, the person who smoked 20 cigarettes a day will actually have more harm done to their body than a person who's taken heroin every day. The danger with that is that there's always a risk of overdose, which isn't with cigarettes. But I think it's just interesting, I suppose, the way that we frame addiction.
How we contextualize these
absolutely.
Things.
So I knew that, you know, the way that I behaved around food was not normal, but I think that when I remember being in group, and I think it wasn't an arrogance, I think it was I sort of looked down, which is so hilarious, because that's the reason why you're in group therapy, but I think I was a little bit like, oh, these people love talking with themselves. So I would, you know, there was always going to be, you know, they'd really, really, and like they were dead right, because they were getting the most out of.
And did you have that
experience
sense of like, you're not going to, I'm going to be the tough nut to crack?
Yeah, well, more like, you know, they would have really had to kind of ask me a lot of questions. You know, I would have never volunteered, you know, I would have really, I suppose I was 21 as well, and I thought I was way too cool for all of this, you know. And I kind of just, I don't know, I think I was a bit like, God, would they ever stop talking? Oh my God, they never stop going on and on and on.
Oh my God.
But I also think that when you're in a situation like that, other people just really, like, which is so good in the book, because, you know, she talks about, and, you know, because obviously she's coming down, and she's, you know, she's on her last nerve, you know, and like just the fury that she feels with the way someone who's sitting next to her is eating, or the way that, you know, well, I mean, thank God we didn't have to share rooms. That when I was reading this book, I was like, shivers. But, you know, the person that she's sharing a room with,
Jackie,
with, you know, CH, not a J, the way she wants to talk on it, you know, and she's just ready to kill all of them. And that's very true. And I suppose what's brilliant about Rachel as well, which I think I hadn't, it's funny, I didn't recognise it at the time, and it's only now when I reread it recently, I really recognised the behaviour of people pleasing and wanting all of them to like her, and kind of wanting to give the best impression of herself, and, you know, wanting to make sure, I suppose, manipulate, really, manipulate the other inmates into, I suppose, that she wanted to manipulate them into thinking about her in a certain way. I could definitely recognise that from the way that I was when I was in St. John of God's, but I didn't recognise that at the time. But I thought that was really skillfully done as well, because that's such a tenet, I think, of addiction, is this feeling of worthlessness, and, you know, wanting to, I suppose, wanting people to love you because you feel so intrinsically unlovable that the only way that you can feel as if maybe you are worthy of that love is if it's coming from other people. Like, you know, an internal sort of sense of self-love would just be completely worthless, because anything that would come from you or yourself would be worthless. But yes, I think that's really, Marion just does that so beautifully in the book as well.
And what's interesting, actually, you know what, I'm going to do a quick plot summary. I think most people, because this is one of the books that people have asked for the most.
Oh, no way.
It really has. I think it's...
They're probably listening going, and now we have to listen to Louise O'Neill talk about addiction. And it's like, can we talk about the book?
No, I think it's all linked, because... And I think one of the reasons why this book is as popular and as requested as it is because it's one of the few books that deals with female addiction. And I don't think women are used to seeing their addiction stories. Like, we're so used to seeing addiction within the framework of, like, your Hunter S. Thompsons and these very, very masculine stories. And, like... What I find so interesting about female addiction stories is because so much of the addict experience is like, I don't give a fuck what people think. I'm just going to go into my K-hole and just abuse myself. And it's a kind of romanticness of the outlaw. Mm. But then so much of the experience of being female is about having people look at you and wanting to be looked at and wanting for that image to be the right thing. And I think when you get female addiction stories, you get those two things completely in combat, which is why it's so unique.
That's true. That's a really good point.
I'm going to do a quick plot summary just for people who haven't caught up. Rachel Walsh is a 20-something living in New York and has a fondness for men, shoes, and recreational cocaine. She accidentally overdoses. Her family bring her back to Dublin and admit her to the Cloisters, Ireland's answer to the Betty Ford Clinic. It's here where Rachel is forced to confront the reality of her addiction, take responsibility for her destructive behaviour, namely with her ex-boyfriend Luke and her best friend Bridget. Despite the lessons she learns in the Cloisters, this doesn't stop her from dramatically relapsing and forcing to piece her life together once again. What I really love is how the roots of Rachel's addiction are really, really slowly unwrapped throughout the novel. So I think it begins, you kind of sort of take for granted that she's like, okay, she's a bit of an insecure 20-something. She's in New York. She loves going to parties. She's fallen down a rabbit hole of using cocaine and fallen with the wrong crowd, so to speak. And then we get back, we kind of keep peeling back these layers and layers, and you get back to eventually Rachel at 3 years old, just unhappy that it kind of gradually tells the story of her little sister Anna. Is born, her mother suffers from postpartum depression. Her grandfather had just died as well. Her father had to go to Manchester. Basically, all these things happen that happen in any normal family, and often in Irish families don't get spoken about and just get sort of run over. And the young Rachel internalizes all these things as she kind of internalizes it as the following: I was mean to my little sister. My mother is now crying all the time. My father has gone away. I am responsible for all of this thing. And she's completely calcified that mess and then just like built that on top of her. And her therapist is saying to her, like, you were a 3-year-old child. There's no way that could have been your fault. You simply weren't that important. And Rachel's like, I was that important. How dare you? And it's like that thing of like where sort of narcissism meets complete self-hatred.
Yes, yes. And I think it is that, and the therapist, Josephine, I think, says that, doesn't she? It's like where ego meets low self-esteem.
Mm.
And that's kind of the crux, I suppose, of the of Rachel's addiction. But it is, it's masterful, actually. And I think one of the things that I think is so brilliant about Marion's books is that they deal with such important issues, and I think things that really directly impact, you know, women and women's lives. And then she writes about them in such a way that is really funny and accessible,
and just with a lightness of touch,
yes,
and a specificity.
Yes, it's very deft, you know, so you never feel like you're kind of being hit over the head with it. And I think what's so important about her work is that, you know, I think it's 38 million or something now, you know, that copies of her books have sold worldwide. So it's 38 million, probably mostly women, you know, who are reading about addiction or body image issues or domestic violence or rape or alcoholism or depression or, you know, and I think that's what's so incredible, is that her voice is so important because she is being read by so many people, you know, that she's amplifying, I think, these stories in such a huge way.
And it's also, it's like, and these women are so... And it's such a cliche within this genre of like, oh, she's a gal just like you. She loves shoes and she's insecure about her weight. But I think what it does to you then is like, you care so much about the Rachels and the, you know, the Claires and all of the Walsh girls so much, because they are just sort of ordinary girls, that it kind of does the thing of you. If you're reading a 700 page novel about a girl like you who has addiction and it matters, or a girl like you who is in a domestic violence relationship and it matters, you slowly begin to realize the things that happened to me also matter, you know? And I think that's what Marion is so fantastic at. It's like, our lives are not these trivial things, and our like, we can be funny, but like joke, like just sort of kicking dirt over your psychosis with a joke or with sure, you know me, I love a bit of cocaine, me, kind of thing, is not dealing with things, you know.
And it's just, I suppose, you can really see with Rachel, you can see how this would have happened. You could, you know, that I suppose that she was probably someone who was quite vulnerable, you know, that she was a child who was very sensitive, and then circumstances kind of outside of her control, and then the family that she was born into, and then I suppose going to live in a city like New York, where it is very easy. I mean, I've lived in New York as well. Rachel is me, basically.
There's a lot of touch points for you in this novel.
And I suppose it's such an easy city to buy into, that some people are more important than others, or that it's, you know, how you look or how
something
much money
Rachel
you have.
Completely buys into.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's easy to do that because, you know, even if you're someone who I think hasn't got an addictive personality or isn't very insecure, like, it is this sort of, I suppose, because everyone is, you know, she talks about that, you know, where that it's really hard to find a man because every woman is sort of like a supermodel, and they're like, oh, you know, I'm a quarter Italian and a third this, and you're like, that is actually very true. And I suppose every, you know, it's like everyone's really there's a lot of money, and, you know, the clothes are beautiful, and there's, it's just, you know, celebrity, and, you know, that's so celebration as well. And I think that you can just see how, I suppose, with Rachel, it's like a perfect storm of all of these different vulnerabilities, or, you know, like frailties, that like any addiction, that it's not a, you can't kind of point to one thing and say this is the reason, that it's a combination of many different, it's very multifaceted, it's a combination of many different factors, which is why sometimes with treatment, like, I think that it's really important to also take a multi sort of disciplinary approach to the way that you're going to treat addiction, because in the same way that it's not just one thing that's caused it, which you can see so clearly with Rachel in this book, you also can't, there's not just going to be just one thing that's going to kind of cure it as well. I think there's a few different things that you kind of have to look at.
Just as there's sort of many ways to treat addiction and many ways it can begin. What I love about this novel as well is that it shows the different ways addiction manifests in different sort of class systems within Ireland, kind of thing. We get such a comprehensive view because Ireland is a country so associated with addiction. And we get, like, very towards the beginning of the group sessions that they have in this novel, and they're punctuated throughout with basically different members of her little gang in the cloisters kind of being put on stage, and these people who we kind of accept as being, oh, there's your man and he loves to eat Mars bars and he plays, you know, Scrabble or something in the rec room, then they get completely torn to shreds and exposed in these group situations. And we start with someone like John Joe, who is, he absolutely upsets me so much.
I know.
And he's just this old, much older man, and it's your classic Irish addiction story.
Yeah.
And it begins with like, oh, sure, you know, you'd be lonely up in the farm now and you'd have the drink and da-da-da. And Rachel's almost bored because she's like, oh, this is going to be one of those stories where, like, he couldn't afford to marry because his brother inherited the farm. Yeah. Like, she says probably some Irish economic reason that he's a drunk, which is so true. And then it's sort of, like, unfurled into this, like, really, like, really,
I know,
poignant story about him being gay, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's... It really, yeah, because I remember that being a real surprise, because you said you're just not expecting it, because I think he's well into his 60s, you know.
Yeah.
It's just a thread that runs through the entire book is this idea of, you know, you're only as sick as your secrets. And so many of them have kept, you know, I suppose really important parts of their lives secret, in the same way that John Joe, you know, just didn't feel able to express that part of himself. Having grown up in a very rural area that, you know, I suppose, I doubt there was a huge, like, gay scene and whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
like, Westmeath or
wherever he was, you know, he was from. And then he really felt like he had to deny that. And I think when you deny such a primal, just vital part of yourself, you know, that, like, that has to, I suppose, manifest itself in some way, you know.
And again, it's this complete lightness of touch, because I think the therapist, Josephine, asks him to say something like, tell us a story about your father, and he tells us, like, really this pure farmer story about, like, accidentally killing a pig or something. And then he's like, oh, and my dad put me up on his shoulders or something like that. And she's like, and how did he feel? And she's like, strong. And I felt very protected. And then it kind of goes on to, like, and how do you feel when you're with men? Like, and they feel strong and I feel very protected. And then it's just like, there's like a beat of silence within the room as the whole room realizes
this, what's
the deal here?
What's happening?
Yeah. And it's never completely like, I just feel, he's never betrayed by the book. It's never like played for laughs. And it's just like, it's this incredibly tender little story. And then there's just so many other characters who have similar kinds of stories. And then you've got at the other end of the sort of socioeconomic spectrum, you get someone like Jackie, who's like this complete, like, notionsy, upper middle class sort of.
Yes. Yeah. And then you have, you know, as you said, there's people who are working class. And I suppose just to see the tension between, because, you know, I suppose we have this idea, I suppose, of Ireland, you know, being quite a classless society, I suppose, particularly in comparison to our nearest neighbour. And I think that, but there is, you know, obviously, there are different tiers here, obviously, you know, and most of that is tied in with wealth. And it's just really interesting, I suppose, to see the dynamics kind of play out between them. Like, there's, you know, they're playing Trivial Pursuit, you know, that bit where it's so funny. And one of them, Stalin? I can't remember what the nickname, not actual Stalin. He's not
they call him Stalin because he's got a big mustache.
Yeah. And that he knows all the answers, and that the guy that he's playing with thinks that he's cheating, so he gets his wife to bring in a different
trivial pursuit,
and the guy still knows all the answers.
And he's like a Northsider from Dublin.
Yes, and Rachel, you know, is silently thinking to herself that you could just tell that he's dying to say, how do you know all the answers? You know, you're working class, but that, like, he can't kind of come out with it. And I just thought that was such a well observed moment of a very particular type of middle class Irish person who would have all of these ideas and preconceptions around what a working class person should know, and their, I suppose, their education and their ability, and that's completely turned on its head as well. I just thought that was just,
it's fantastic. It's really,
and it's just it's so only good. A few lines, you know, that kind of way, but it's just like, so well done.
I think it wasn't Mark Twain, but it was someone like Mark Twain who said something like, the English have a class system and they won't stop talking about it.
Yeah.
And the Irish have a class system, but they won't tell you what it is.
Oh, that's really good. I wonder who said that, the sexist.
Yeah, someone analogous to Mark Twain, but not Mark Twain.
Probably. I don't think he would have cared too much about the Irish, but yeah. Maybe I'm wrong.
It's wrong to call it a love triangle, but it's a love triangle in as much as we're living in a flashback with Rachel half of the time and in the present day in the other half of the time. And in the flashback, she's very much concerned with her boyfriend, Luke.
I love Luke.
What an interesting character, because he's kind of a sexy loser.
Yeah. But he's... Oh, I love him. But it's just... Well, I can understand, because... Like, they do sound ridiculous. Like, you know, he's like, why do you keep making fun of my friends? And I'm like, well, it does sound like you. I mean, I feel like it probably would be quite easy to mock, you know, that they kind of sound like they're, like, the way I nearly picture them is, like, Def Leppard or something,
somewhere between Def Leppard and, like, Wayne's World.
Yeah.
And they have, as we mentioned at the beginning, they have part ownership in a pair of leather trousers, and they each have a turn wearing the leather trousers.
That's so good. So I suppose Luke is he's such a great character, and I think it's, again, maybe I'm like giving away too much of myself, but I really recognised that, I suppose, it's so brilliantly done, the way like Rachel meets this guy. You know, he's not cool. He's really nice to her. He's really sexy. Like, their sex
really great sex scenes
Sex scenes are not easy to write.
No, they're
like, especially
very
sexy
hard.
Sex scenes, like, you know, that are actually like, oh, this is kind of hot. Like, that's even more rare, to be honest. But so he's really, they have an incredible, they have incredible chemistry. And it's such a kind of a push-pull. And like, when he's kind of pulling away, like, because Rachel's been awful to him, like,
and she's awful.
Oh my god, like, awful. And I mean, it's you know, you know that it's part of the addiction, and you know that this isn't, you know, her, but like, some of the ways that she treats him is like, do you know that bit where he comes over and that guy Daryl, who's just such a creep, is there, but she thinks is more impressive, you know, he's got this, well, what she thinks is quite a cool job at a publisher, and you know, Luke says, oh, what's he doing here, and she says, oh, just pretend you're my brother. Like, it's just like your heart would need to be ripped out of your chest.
And the fact that and it's weird, because at the beginning of the novel, when she has this failed suicide attempt, Luke kind of walks in and he says to her, you're not the person I thought you were, and he breaks up with her. And as the reader, you're like, if your girlfriend just tried to kill herself.
Yes, he's being really hard. You think he's being incredibly harsh.
Yeah, you're well shot at him.
Yeah, he's a jerk. Yeah. And then I suppose it just goes through, and like, he's really kind to her. Like, he's really, and they have so, like, they have just this, they get on so well. Like, you could just tell this is the sort of couple that would be best friends, you know, while also having this insane, like, sexual chemistry. And so when she's horrible to him and he pulls away, then she gets really anxious and she's kind of trying to win him back. And then as soon as, and it's just, oh, and it's that part where she talks about when he's really lovely to her, that she feels nearly revulsed by him. And I was like, oh God, I just know what that's like. So familiar. Like,
has that been your reaction in relationships before?
100%. And I've talked about this, but like, my current boyfriend, he was just the most, genuinely, like, I know, like, hashtag best, but like, he is just the best thing that's ever happened to me. But at the beginning of our relationship, and I thought I was, you know, I had been in recovery and I thought I was doing really well. I actually really struggled with, I realized that I felt very uncomfortable with someone being very kind to me. And that I had been in sort of, I wouldn't even call it a relationship, but something else kind of previously, where the person was very emotionally unavailable, and I never knew where I stood, and I was upset. I couldn't stop thinking about him, and, you know, just because he would never ring, or, you know, that, you know, and I just was so fixated on it, I think. And I realized at the start of the relationship that I'm in currently that it was because I felt more comfortable in that situation, because anyone who would, it's a bit like, you know, what's that quote, you know, I don't want to be a member of a club that would have me as a member type thing, you know? So it was this sensation of, well, what's wrong with this person if he wants to be with me? And I also think that with someone who had no interest, there was a part of me that was like, this person sees the truth of who I am. They know that I'm not worthy of being loved. So if I can persuade this person to love me, then I can believe myself that I'm worthy of being loved. And I thought she just, that's, you can see that dynamic with Rachel, where that when he's being loving and kind, she actually feels like nearly like a physical sense of like revulsion. And she, it's a bit like, well, what's wrong with you? Like, why, like she's to Luke, like, why would you, you know, mentally think, like she doesn't actually say this to him, but I think she's silently like, why would you?
And she's so obsessed with impressive people.
Yes.
And she's always hanging out with people who are working in like interesting quote unquote jobs. And
yes.
People who are really good looking. And all she cares about is going to like great parties and stuff. That it's sort of his interest in her compounds her belief that he is not a member of the set that she 100%. So desperately wants to
yeah.
be in.
And they're all awful. The people that she's... Because I was like, at least when I was in New York and the people I was hanging out with were really glam and beautiful, but they were actually genuinely nice people. So
yeah.
Like, these people are fucking bitches, like Helenka and Jessica, and, you know, just really mean and awful. And I think part of her, I think that if they had been nice to her again, she would have just had no time for them whatsoever
yeah.
because that's how she treats herself as well. And there's also this scene with Luke that I thought was just incredible, where they're sitting down, they're watching, I think, a movie, and they're having a really good night. And then all of a sudden, she just has this really strong urge that
yeah.
she's like, she needs to take coke. And he goes from being her companion, and they've, you know, that she feels really comfortable and cozy with him, to being like this obstacle in the way of her getting what she needs to get, you know, to have, as was to satisfy that craving. So she tries to go, you know, she's like, oh, I just have to go. And he feels really confused. And he's like, I don't understand. I thought we were having a really nice night. And
yeah.
she leaves, you know, straight away. And that is really familiar, I think, to anybody who has
yeah.
had any sort of addiction, because it can come upon you and you just, it really is such a barrier in the way of having any sort of really close relationships, because, you know, it's very difficult if people are like, oh, do you want to go away for a weekend? And you're like, oh, I would like to go away for a weekend, but will I have enough time to satisfy this addiction
yeah.
while we're away? Or will you want to be with me all the time? Will we be sharing a room? And how will I cope with that? Will I start getting really irritable?
Yeah.
And angry with you, and will that kind of create friction through? So it's just this constant thing that you're trying to sort of navigate throughout your whole entire life, and it really limits the choices you make and the things you do and the places you can go.
It is that barrier between you and other people,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah,
and that's
true
why
intimacy,
it's attractive
you know?
In some ways.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely, you know? Because I think the thing is with it is that, especially with these kind of relationships, which I think you can see with Rachel and Luke, is that she says she wants to be in a relationship and she says she wants to have a boyfriend, but I don't think she's actually able to have that sort of true intimacy, because that would mean being honest and being vulnerable. And I think those are two things that she would just never allow.
And she has that sort of deep, deep sort of belief that the person that she is kind of repugnant kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that she has managed to sort of have the sort of veneer of like being a really good laugh to be around, of being funny and stuff. But if you get past that veneer
yeah.
of sociability, you will find this kind of quite dark person.
Yes, and
that
she feels broken.
Yeah.
yeah. And I suppose, I mean, to be fair, the way she's been brought up. I mean, I know, because I love the Walsh.
The Walshes are
they're amazing,
good. Yeah.
But like, I'd say it would be chaotic, do you know? I mean,
yeah.
I only have one sister, so I don't know what it would be like growing up with like four other sisters. And her poor mother, as I say, and her poor father. You know, they would definitely be a need, I think, for some intensive family therapy there all of them. But
she was like, living with Helen alone would kill you. Like.
I love Helen though, oh
yeah.
God.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information, information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Throughout the novel, Josephine is kind of saying to her therapist, oh no, it's you know, a combination of the person that you are in terms of how you were born. Like she kind of says in a very tactful way, some people are short-sighted,
yeah.
Some people are born with very sensitive emotions, and then you were, you know, the kind of middle child in this growing family, and she's kind of like, what, so everybody who has a little sister is a drug addict kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then she kind of later on, when she gets out of the cloisters, which are kind of some of those painful chapters in the book, really, because she starts off with this thing of, you know, she's going to go to her meetings and all this, and she thinks she's grand, and she thinks she's grand, and then she relapses terribly. Mm. And she can't understand, and what it comes down to is sort of, she can't understand why her sisters aren't as affected by their mother's kind of, not dislike of them, but
no.
A kind of a sort of a removedness from them.
I think she just has, she snaps, I think, you know, there's no patience with their mother. Do you know that if one of them is kind of annoying her, she'll say it, and she won't couch it in insensitive language. You know, it'll just be like, you're being really annoying. You know, like there's just this kind of quite a bluntness, I think, about the way that she speaks. And Rachel just takes that so much to heart. And the scenes where she relapses they're very distressing, but also I think that was a really important thing to add in, because relapse is a huge part of recovery, actually. And for most people, you know, it's very common, and you know, you see people, you know, that have to, you know, go in and out of hospital, you know, two or three times, and actually it's very hard for the people around you, because I think that every time that you relapse, they believe in your recovery a little tiny but a little bit less.
It's
you know,
very well put. Yeah,
yeah, you know, and then I think that makes it harder for you nearly to believe in it as well. And I think that when you're in these treatment centers, you really, I remember going in and being like, oh, I'll be fixed by the end of this 3 months, you know, like this is it, you know, it'll be done, and that'll be grand, and I'll just go on with my life. And it wasn't like that at all. And I think that that's what's really effective. And I suppose I remember that line that her sister says to her, because Rachel is so distraught when she wakes up in hospital after having relapsed.
Very upsetting relapse.
Yeah. So yeah, like it was a really rock bottom type of,
like, goes to like the worst pub in the world.
Yeah.
Finds a teenager to buy
methadone.
Yeah.
Like it's so, because I suppose, and actually I think there's something about that is so important, because at the start, I suppose, the way that Rachel sees her addiction, the way that she sees her drug taking
is
quite
so
glamorous.
It's couched in New York glamour, isn't
it? You know, and it's like, this is really cool, and when I take it, I feel fabulous, and, you know, and other people are taking it, and it's, you know, for a lot of people, it's fine, and they can take it, and it's, I sound like, but, you know, I think it's a bit like alcohol or food, you know, the way some people have issues with these things, and then other people can... Mm-hmm. You know, drink, and they can, you know, take coke occasionally and not form addictions, you know. But you know, so I think it's really different than how kind of
seedy.
Yes, yeah. That's the word I was looking for. It's so seedy, and you can tell that, you know, it isn't, I suppose, even at the beginning of the book, it's still portrayed as, I'm doing it for fun, you know, I'm doing it to enjoy myself, whereas there's nothing about, this is not the reason why she's going out and she's looking for drugs when she relapses, is not about having fun, or it is not about, you know, going out on a night in New York, you know, dressed to the nines in her Alaya dress and, you know, looking fabulous. It is about that she wants to obliterate herself. She does not want to feel the pain that she's in, which is really what addiction is about anyway. It is a painkiller, whatever your kind of substance of choice. It is a way of numbing out all of that pain. And then when she comes to in the hospital, and her sisters are
she
there.
She gets hit by a car.
And the guys that she's with just like leave her for dead, basically. And when she wakes up in the hospital, and you know, she's so distraught, because I suppose again it's that very addict kind of mentality of all or nothing. Mm. And her sister says, which was something I've really kept kind of close to my heart for a long time, is she said, it's like when you're on a diet and one day you go mad and eat 7 Mars bars, and then the next day you get up and you kind of just get back on the I think there is an element of that where you just have to keep trying and you have to keep hoping. And I mean, obviously it works out very well for Rachel, but I know my recovery was, you know, very up and down for years, and it's only really in the last 2 years, I think, it's been a proper, where now we can properly say I'm well, you know. And so I think that you have to keep hoping.
It's like you have to wake up and cut the tail off every day.
Yeah, absolutely. But even in the worst of times, I think it was a sense of I just had to keep the faith that it would come at some point, because otherwise I think, you know, you would just give up.
And what's interesting about her relapse as well is that it comes directly after. We haven't mentioned Chris yet.
I didn't want to talk about him.
So, is he too triggering for you? Yeah. That's a character.
Oh God, that sex scene is...
Oh. So Chris is a guy she meets in the cloisters, and it's that pure thing, and I've been a victim of this many times myself, of like, I will go into any room, and like, I am basically a married woman. I've been in a monogamous relationship for 5 years, and I will just look for the person to have a crush on, like man, woman, or beast. I need to have a crush on someone in every room. And she just kind of goes in, she's like, who is the best looking person who's my age and a man? And she fixates on Chris.
Yeah.
And he's kind of been through it a few times, and he kind of really poses himself as a sort of sage addict kind of thing.
That's, you know what, honestly, that is the worst part of it, I think, is just the fact that he's like, yeah, you know, and he just seems like the voice of reason all the time, and he seems like he really has it together, and he just seems so wise, and he's just so completely full of, which she would have seen this as if she had been in his group, but she isn't in
she
wasn't in his group, which I think was a very good kind of narrative choice. But he's so manipulative, incredibly so. Mm. And she can't see it, and I think that she he keeps making these jokes, you know, which are really suggestions, you know, like he'll make a joke about having sex in the laundry room or something. And we've all been there, you know, we've all been there with guys that have done that.
The plausible deniability guy.
Yeah, and you can't say, well, now you would, but like, you know, like, at 27, which is the age that she is in this book, I wouldn't have anyway made a big deal out of it. Mm. I would have been like, oh, shit, I don't want to seem dry.
I don't want to seem like I'm not a laugh.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was the most important thing.
Yeah.
That was
the only important thing when you're 27.
And like, it's just... He's pushing her boundaries. He's testing her boundaries to see see how receptive she is to it, to see if she'll say, what do you mean by that? Or like, fuck off, or, you know, or that's a bit weird.
Yeah.
But she laughs. She kind of just, you know, she's looking for his approval. She's not really sure what he means by that. And she doesn't want to ask him, whereas, you know, like... I think Rachel in 10 years at 37, after 10 years of recovery, would be very much like, I'm sorry, what do you mean by that?
Yeah.
But she would never have said that at that stage, you know? But it's just really interesting to see him just kind of test her, you know?
And it is what we were talking about earlier on. It's that sort of difference between men's addiction and women's addiction and how the way we're socialized genderly?
That's gonna be a word.
Gender. I'm amazing it isn't some kind of like fun queer website. Gender.ly. The gender roles that are pushed on us and how they interact with things like addiction. Mm. In that, I think, in my experience, I've had a lot of people very close to me who are addicts and who are also men, and the unbelievable manipulation that they're able to deploy is very masterful, and also I'm thinking of one very good friend who had a coke addiction for a long time, and the onus was always on me to be more interesting than cocaine.
Oh, Jesus.
You know? And you could see sort of his eyes flitting away, and I'd be like, no, I have a story. It's about my boobs. Yeah. Like, you know.
Wow. And that is like just a lot of pressure to put on someone.
How can you be more interesting than cocaine? I mean, it's from South America.
Especially to an addict. I'm like, that is impossible, you know?
Yeah.
Wow, you know, it's when you say that, it just reminds me of you know, Kat Marnell. Do you know?
Yes.
She was the writer for How to Murder Your Life.
Murder Your Life.
She was a writer for XO Jane. She was a beauty writer with Condé Nast. I can't remember which publication she was with now. And then she came on with XO Jane, and she was their beauty editor, and she wrote these like. I loved her. I thought she was an amazing writer. But they were crazy. Do you know? That word is probably a bit ableist. But anyway, you know, they were a little bit off the wall, shall we say? And so she wrote a lot about addiction, and then she would write these rambling pieces about conditioner, and then tie in this, you know, rehab that she had gone to in upstate New York. Like, they were
gonzo internet style of writing.
Yes, absolutely, but they were brilliant. But I remember she wrote this piece, it was after Whitney Houston died, and it's one of those pieces, I haven't been able to sort of put it out of my mind since. And she talked about how, you know, because Whitney died in the bathtub, and she was saying that she had taken, that she felt like that could have happened to her so many times, because so many times that she was just out of it, that she just wanted to get in the bath and kind of... just, you know, float away or whatever. And she talked about how often we don't want to discuss women's addiction, because we want the recovery story. We want the I was an addict or I was an alcoholic, but now I'm better, you know, and I've gone through this and I've become a yoga instructor, or I went to Peru to drink ayahuasca, and now I've, you know, I don't know, opened up my own business, and I have.
I think because women's turnover. Stories are so much about the before and after.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we're only interested in the after. You know, we don't want. And I think what she was saying was that there is still a merit in, you know, women should be allowed to be messy, and in the same way that men are allowed to be, I suppose. They're allowed to express that part of themselves, or they're allowed to talk about their struggles in that way that I think that women aren't. But we see that all the time. Like, if you look at the way that Amy Winehouse, like the way that Amy Winehouse was treated and framed in the media was very different to the way, say, someone like a Kurt Cobain was, you know. We excuse addiction in men, particularly men that we think
are geniuses.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in women, because we want women to be well behaved, and to be nice and to be tidy and to take up, I think, a lot less space in the world, we're not as interested in allowing them the messiness of addiction, unless it's something like anorexia or something like that, where that will silence them. And I think that we sort of think that's okay for women, you know. And I mean, I saw that even when I remember... when I was going, I went to a couple of different places before I went into John of God's, and I went to a centre, which I think the Cloisters is actually is based upon, just to, you know, but I was too thin. You have to be, like, they can't legally take you if you're under a certain weight, because, like, you need to be in a hospital. Do you know that kind of way? And you're at too much of a risk. They're we can't take you, because you need to be able to be monitored, like, with heart machines, whatever.
Sure.
But I went in for a where you go into a group session, and it was really interesting, because there was two alcoholics, I think there was two drug addicts, a guy who was addicted to gambling, and there was me, so I suppose I was the only person there for food. And it was really interesting to see the sort of mix of class again, you know. And I remember coming out, and there was my mother looked really frightened, because I remember she was sitting there, and there were these two guys, and I think they were from inner city Dublin, talking about heroin or something, and she was like, I can't leave you in here. And I remember when we went to St. John of God's, which was it was a specially designed program for eating disorders, and it was a lot of sort of middle class white girls, you know.
Yeah.
And she felt more comfortable. And I think, you know, 10 years or sorry, 13 years on, the conversation that we would have had would be very different now. And I think that we would both know more now about, I suppose, how we would have internalized certain ideas around class. Like, if she said something like that, like, now, I would be like, that's really problematic. And I think she would be more aware of that now. But that was definitely something that she was like, I feel more comfortable with you being here, because anorexia is seen as
a middle-class girl's illness.
Yes, you know? And I suppose there's something a bit more... I mean, even it's more, I think... I hope that's not offensive now, but anyway, I'm trying to sort of unpick it and sort of unpick, I suppose.
I think as someone who's been through it, you're sort of at liberty to, you know.
Yeah, but I don't want to say, you know, I don't want to be classist either, you know. But I think, you know, it's trying to unpick, I suppose, a lot of that internalized ideas that we have. And I think even with anorexia, that's very much almost celebrated. You know, there's a sense of with people where they say, wow, you must have incredible willpower, you know, when you're like, actually, it was a compulsion. I literally could not have put anything into my mouth, you know. And
there is a, you don't need to be on like pro-Anna sites order to be glamorized anorexia, because it is glamorized in every part of our society.
Absolutely. And even when you see TV shows, you know, that are about anorexia, like there is a kind of a glossy sheen over that, but you know, which is not there when you talk about compulsive overeating. It is not there when you talk about bulimia. Like, you know, that was, because I had bulimia as well, and that was incredibly shameful. You know, that was not something that I would have as readily,
because again, it's messy.
Absolutely. And you know, even now I've noticed that if I'm talking to someone that I don't know that well, I'll say, oh, I was anorexic as a teenager. You know, I won't say, oh, I had really bad bulimia in my early 30s. You know, I just, that feels embarrassing in a way. And I think that that's because with, again, with women that, you know, we're sort of expected to deny certain aspects of ourselves, you know, that we're rewarded if we deny ourselves our hunger or our sexual desire. You know, that we're seen as, you know, that we're being good girls if we can... If we have that, I suppose, that, you know, what people say, that incredible willpower.
And it's tied so much into everything about what being a woman is supposed to be about. Like, even if you think of, like, all the Catholic female saints, it's all about starvation, self-flagellation, seeing visions because you're so fucking hungry.
Jesus. Well, the Virgin Mary never came to me. I'm very disappointed, because I was a very devout child. I would have been absolutely thrilled. But I think, you know, you can see that again, I suppose, with... back to the book, Rachel's Holiday, you know, I suppose the sense of Catholicism is very much tied through it, you know, that she wanted to be a nun when she was a child as well, which I
it's
thought
a sort
was...
of living in a life of extremes, isn't
yes.
it? And of sort of showing your purity by being able to restrict yourself from things. It's quite linked, and Catholic guilt plays a big part in the book as well.
Yes, because I suppose shame, I suppose, you know, that she grew up in a culture, I mean, she's 27 at the time of the book, and the book was released in 1997. So she was brought up in the 70s, which would have still been, you know, like, very much. I mean, really, Ireland until the 90s, it wasn't exactly...
There wasn't a lot of movement between 50 and 85,
Comparison, I suppose, to what you would have seen in other countries where, you know, like, the 60s did not happen here, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they did, maybe we're, like, but I don't think we saw too much evidence of it, except for Edna O'Brien, just the one-woman band, just doing her best. So I suppose Rachel would have been brought up in the 70s, and I think what that's very much running through the book as well is just this incredible sense of shame and the weight of that she carries, and how that ties in to addiction as well.
There's a brilliant passage in the book, and it does link back to it's this bit where she shares a room with her older sister Maggie, who is the sort of, as fans of the Walsh sisters will know, the lick arse of the family, and she's so good, and she's just a nice person, and everyone fucking hates her for it.
Yeah, I know.
And she Maggie has so much self-control that it's September and her Easter egg is still sitting on top of her wardrobe, which is such a clear image. I can see that Easter egg on top of that wardrobe,
and
so clearly.
Do you know what's so funny when you said that to me now? That is so weird, because I didn't realise that I was doing it, but I was visualising that Easter egg in myself and my sister's room that we had when the first house we lived in until I was four, down by Inchtonny Beach, my grandparents' holiday home. And I've only literally just realized now that every time I've read that book, that that's where I pictured that egg
sitting winking at you. Yeah, from top.
But also it's such a perfect analogy for her addiction as well, because it's the compulsion, and also it's the, I suppose, the when she goes, like, the lack of control when she
finally just sinks into it. And she's, and the thing of, like, she's only going to eat the bits that come with the Easter egg, and then she ends up eating half of the Easter egg, and she's like, do you know what, I'll leave the front half of the shell in the thing, and it's so, because in the kind of cellophane where you can see through it, so she'll think it's still there. And it's like the reasoning of an addict being like, it's still good.
Oh my god. But also it's just such a perfect, you know, because as I said,
the symbol of the Easter egg as well.
Yeah,
you know,
it's exactly. Just... And also, I suppose it's that thing of, I suppose, with addiction, is that you don't know where to stop. Do you know that other people know, like, know the one that's one too many, you know, that other people know that's enough now.
Yeah.
But that you can't, like, you don't see that. Like, you kind of keep pushing beyond that, you know? And it's just so perfectly just encapsulated in that moment. The panic just sends in.
Oh, and then what happens next? And it's again, that thing that's rendered so well in this book in particular. That child memory thing.
Yeah.
Of, like, so she's, at that point, I think she's about 4, so she's not at school yet, and Maggie is at school, and she knows that when Maggie comes home from school, she's gonna rat in there, she's gonna be in trouble, and she's, like, quaking with the fear and the sugar rush and everything. Yeah. Which is, I'm gonna be in so much trouble.
And I'm gonna say that it was like a thief going house to house stealing Easter. She thinks this is, like, a really legit, it's like, way really out legit, of this, you know? Like,
and then she goes with her mom to sort of collect the girls from school, and they come back, and the mom has, like, lost her front door key.
Yeah.
And then they're all sitting outside. It's, like, September, it's getting dark, and they're waiting for the dad to come home. And, like, the kind of, the sense of delayed punishment is getting further and further. And she's like, oh God, they're gonna, like, we're sitting out here, and it's terrible, and this is a punishment somehow, but also the real punishment is coming later.
Yeah.
And it just, like, fuses in her memory. And it's so specific that I have to believe. It's like, obviously I want to give novelists the credit of coming up with things, but it just feels so lived in that moment.
Yeah, like you're wondering
that happened.
Yeah, I'll have to ask her. But actually, what I think, what I love so much about all the Walsh sister books is that how each of them, because I suppose, you know, Claire is the first one, and I think Rachel is the second one, and up until that point, the other three, Margaret, Anna, and Helen, seem almost like caricatures, you know, not caricatures, you know, because they don't seem like, but they're, you know, they're quite, like, I suppose, in the way that you would see your sisters in, like, this is, they have very defined roles.
Yeah, everyone has two characteristics.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, and, like, that's your role, and that's your role, and that's your role. And what I think is so brilliant about each of the books is that it completely subverts that. You know, like with Margaret and Paul, when they're angels. You know, it's like as if, because they're the ones, you know, that he's tight and she's a real licorice, and then you sort of see that, like, that's not at all what they're like, or how other people outside of the family see them. And Helen, which I thought was brilliantly done The Mystery of Mercy Close, because she is just such a hilarious character throughout the other ones, and then I just to see her struggle with depression is just. It's just so, it's beautiful. It's the only word I can use to describe it, because I suppose it just so perfectly encapsulate how we do tend to, particularly in family, you know, like they call them like family systems and family dynamics. And actually when one person changes, it can be very threatening. Even if it's a good change, it can be very threatening to the other people within that system, because it completely, you know, upends the status quo. So that's why when you're living away, let's say if you live in Australia and you come home for Christmas, and you come home for Christmas and you're like, why am I behaving like a 16-year-old?
Oh yeah, you don't recognize yourself.
Yeah,
do you?
Because you have to. That's part, like, you literally, unless you change those dynamics, you literally have to come home and play your role as this is the sort of the person that you have to be, even if you're a completely different person within your work life and within the family.
As someone who's currently on a week at home and who generally lives in London, I relate very much. Like, when I'm in London, I'm a pretty together person. I'm always on time. Like, I'm pretty, like, you know, I got my shit together. Yesterday I went for a drive with my mom, I left the fucking boot open. Like, and I was like, and everyone's like, oh, pure Caroline. See? Like, she's a space cadet, head in the clouds, that's her thing. I'm like, oh my god, you expect this from me, and therefore I perform it.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and I just think it's really clever the way she kind of, you know, goes into each of those characters and gives them their own narrative, and you see, I suppose, know that they're actually very fully fleshed individuals within their own lives. It's just how I suppose they're seen through their siblings' eyes is very different to how they see themselves.
Yeah, it's a kind. It's a way in which we never really see sisters. Like, I always was very frustrated with like books like Little Women because I always found them. I feel like Little Women was only just ever an excuse for girls to self-identify as Jo. And I just find all the other characters, apart from Amy, are really boring.
Can we talk about how Winona Ryder and Saoirse Ronan are both too beautiful to be playing
right?
Jo? Yes, I'm like, no.
Get away with this. We need more plain actresses in Hollywood.
Yes.
Everyone looks like Lily Collins now. Everyone's just like...
Yeah. But anyway,
I always think I'm looking at Lily Collins.
You're probably never looking at her, poor Lily Collins. But, anyway. but yeah, so no. With the Little Women, it's funny. I'm really interested to see the update. I have to say, I'd be much more interested in seeing the Walsh sisters on TV.
I can't believe that we haven't seen them because the scope for the Netflix miniseries.
Oh my god, unbelievable.
One like season per unbelievable. Sister.
Yeah. You know? So I think there has been
Watermelon was made into a film.
Yes. With
Anna Friel?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think there has been sort of murmurings about that and I was like, oh, it'd be brilliant. But also such great roles for actresses.
Oh my god.
Wouldn't Sarah Green? Wouldn't she be amazing as Helen?
I know who she is now.
Okay, Sarah Green. I'm trying to think of something that you would have seen that she was in.
Well, that's a good question, actually. How would we cast Rachel Zahler?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Who would I cast? Now that I have Sarah Green in my head.
I know so few Irish actresses, which is a bad thing.
I know. I suppose because automatically you go, oh, Saoirse Ronan.
Yeah, exactly.
Saoirse Ronan. Well, Saoirse Ronan would be great because she's an amazing actress. I'm terrible at this. You know, it's really funny whenever, I'm sure you get this as well, when people are like, how would you cast your books? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't work in film. There's a reason why I write books.
Oh, I always know.
Do you?
I always start a Pinterest board whenever I start a new book. Okay. And then I put actors in it and I print it out.
Oh, see, I usually do. Actually, it's really funny because let's say with Emma and Asking For It, there's a girl, or a woman, should I say, in Clonakilty who I based her physically upon. And it's really, because I've told my boyfriend, and every time we pass him, he goes, oh, there's Emma. And I literally never said it to this woman because I just always thought it would be really weird.
We need to go away soon because we've already run over time.
Oh, okay.
But before you go, The Surface Breaks is out on paperback now.
Yes. And I really, because I loved the original cover, but the new cover is absolutely stunning as well.
Very haunting.
And yeah, it's fab. And they made me, I think the reason why I said made me was I was really busy at the time they asked me to do this and I was like, oh, grand. But they asked me very nicely to do an extra chapter written from the perspective of the Sea Witch. And the Sea Witch in my version of The Surface Breaks, which is a feminist retelling of The Little Mermaid. I just absolutely loved her. She was just such a badass and just a really beautiful fat woman who was really comfortable in her sexuality. So I was really excited at the idea of writing a chapter sort of written from her perspective when she's a teenager. So that is sort of the bonus
bonus content.
Yes, exactly, bonus content.
I love that books have bonus content now. It's like old DVD menus.
Yes, exactly. That is literally it, exactly. So I wrote this really, really, really long extra chapter. So I think it is well worth buying the paperback of The Surface Breaks just for that bonus chapter.
Fab, and that's out with Scholastic and it's available in all good bookshops and probably some poor bookshops as well. thank you so much, Louise.
Thank you.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast, thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.